Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for argument today. The first is People v. Weaver. Council President, ready in that case? All right, we'll take that case first. Second is Drexel Hudgens v. Financial Indemnity. Council President, ready in that case? All right, we'll take that case second. I think council have argued here before. Let me just briefly review the ground rules. These cases are set for 15 minutes aside. The appellant may reserve whatever part of the 15 minutes you want for rebuttal. You'll be guided by a lighting system that is shown on the podium. It works as follows. When your argument commences, a green light will come on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light will come on. And when the full 15 minutes have expired, the red light will come on, which signals you that you need to conclude your argument. Feel free to adjust the podium by use of a toggle switch, up or down, to suit your comfort level. We would ask you to stay close to the podium because we're recording your arguments. We find it helpful sometimes to return to the tape and to listen to it again. And if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well. Also be advised that your arguments are available over the internet within a few days following today. So if there's anything of a sensitive nature you don't wish to disclose, be guided accordingly. We've read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth. So to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us. But the case is yours to argue as you wish. Finally, if anybody has a cell phone in the audience or a pager, please ensure it's turned off at this time. We're ready for argument.
Good morning. I'm Allison Ruttenberg. I am ADC counsel for Wendell Weaver, the appellant defendant in this case. Mr. Weaver was convicted of both stalking his former girlfriend on the evening of the 12th through the 13th of September 2005, and then of the second-degree murder of her new boyfriend early in the morning of 13th September 2005. I would like to take up the issue of stalking first. I argued in the brief that the evidence was insufficient to establish stalking beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant was charged under the what I call the B1 stalking rather than the more common B3 stalking. And the B1 stalking, there's three elements which the people were required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. For purposes of my argument, I'm saying for argument's sake, let's assume that arguments 1 and 2 have been established, those being that there was at least one credible threat, and second of all, that there was repeated contact by the defendant. The defendant certainly did telephone Nicole during that evening numerous times. Those are in the cell phone records, and he texted her at least 3 times. So it's undisputed there was repeated contact as defined by the statute during the evening of 12th through 13th September.
Pardon me, Ms. Ruttenberg. First of all, can you hear me?
Yes.
I have to sit a little bit away from the microphone because of my injury, and I apologize for that.
I understand.
But weren't there at least also 2 other things? First, there was some indication that ND learned that the defendant was coming to the nightclub where she was with the murder victim. And eventually, doesn't the defendant confront ND and the victim at her father's house? So we, in addition to the texting, we have some additional acts following around and eventually the confrontation that ends up in the murder of the victim.
Yes, well, the murder took place in the parking lot. So obviously that was another contact. I don't believe though that the defendant contacted ND or Nicole actually at the nightclub on that particular night. Now, I'm not conceding or acquiescing that there was sufficient evidence of credible threats. I was just, in my brief, I was just trying to get to the crux of the matter of the argument I was making, that the problem with the proof in this case lay with element 3. Or the biggest problem with the proof in this case lay with element 3, and that's that the repeated contact must be in connection with the threat. It's not enough that there is a threat then there's repeated contact, and then something happens. The contact has to be in connection with the prior threats. And the statute defines conduct in connection with a credible threat to mean acts which further advance, promote, or have a continuity of purpose. And in this case, Nicole testified that the defendant was trying to get a hold of her that night because he wanted his computer back. They had had a breakup several months before. The breakup wasn't altogether amicable, and they were still having disputes as to who was going to keep what property. By that time, they had decided that the defendant was going to get the computer. Nicole had the computer. Nicole was intentionally not giving the computer back to the defendant. She knew he was annoyed about this. She knew he was becoming increasingly annoyed about it, and he wanted the computer back. She knew that's why he was trying to contact her that night, trying to find her, trying to call her, and texting her, but she just didn't want to deal with it that night, and that's how she testified, and her testimony is uncontradicted.
Well, is it that we have to believe her testimony, or do we look at it from the standpoint of an objective reviewer of whether this conduct is in connection with the threat? Because the jury could choose to disbelieve her, correct?
Well, I'm not saying that you have to believe Nicole, but you can't discount her testimony. And I think that the actual language of the text messages is very consistent with what she says happens. He's not texting her, "You better not be going to that club that I warned you not to go to," or "You, if I find you with John, I'm going to do something." His text messages are very neutral as far as any threat goes. He says, "Call me. I'm sad and hurt." And then much later, "Well, you don't have to call me. I understand." So her testimony is very consistent with the text messages we have, rather than what she's saying happened on the telephone, which, of course, there's no recording.
Well, we have a previous threat, though, that you've acknowledged, him saying, if I catch you with another man, there's going to be bad things that happen.
We have two previous threats, alleged threats, that she denies happening.
But there's evidence of them, is there not?
There's hearsay evidence that some friend heard her say that another friend testified to, but she expressly denied on the witness stand that he had ever threatened her. The only thing she said he ever did to her was several months before when they were arguing, and she's the one who started the argument because he had started seeing another girl, that they then got in his car. She opened the door to get out of the car. He gave her a shove to help her on her way out, and she fell out of the car. That's the only thing she said ever happened. All of these things that where we had her friends testifying as to hearsay evidence that he said, if you ever go to that club, I'm going to flash on everybody there. She expressly denied that happened.
But don't we have to accept isn't the standard of review that we have to accept the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, as opposed to accepting the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant?
Well, that's why I'm saying, for purposes of this argument, let's skip over the issue of whether that evidence is sufficient to show a credible threat.
But I mean, even in terms of the in connection with requirement, don't we have to view that in the light most favorable to the prosecution?
Yes, but I'm still saying that I don't see that there's evidence that just because threats were made prior, and maybe you can establish that in the light most reasonable to the prosecution of what actually happened that night, what's established as the reason for why the defendant was trying to contact her, there just isn't enough evidence to show that was in connection with those prior threats.
Well, Ms. Ruttenberg, pardon me for interrupting, but is it an unfair charge to suggest that you are taking these statements, these cell phone statements, out of the context of the whole problem? We have, in the light most favorable to the people, five separate incidents indicating violence, including threats, and not only threats to her, but threats against the fellow who is eventually the murder victim. We then have these things, including "I'm hurt and sad," which maybe that's a reference to I don't have my computer, or maybe it's a reference to you're running around on me. And then we have the notion that he's coming to the club, and then he shows up and stabs this guy to death. So aren't we trying to insulate these statements from their context? And by doing so, isn't that what your argument is? And if we place them in context, doesn't a reasonable person say, oh yes, we see that this contact is associated with this bad stuff?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that it was the prosecution that was trying to take those statements out of context rather than put them in the context of how Nicole was trying to paint the picture of that evening, that she was in no way fearful of the defendant that night. She wasn't feeling stalked, harassed, or threatened at all. She knew exactly why the defendant was trying to contact her, and she knew exactly why he was trying to contact her, but she was deliberately trying to duck him because she didn't want to give the computer back, but she also didn't want to talk to the defendant while she was in the presence of the other man because she knew of the prior history between the defendant and the other man. So you have to put the only objective evidence we have of the communications into that context, and there's nothing violent about those communications. See, I'm sad and hurt. I don't think he's sad and hurt because of his computer. He's sad and hurt because she won't talk to him, and I think from the rest of the evidence at the trial, it was pretty clear that he was sad and hurt that they had broke up, and he wishes that they had never broke up. But the argument I made in the opening brief was there was still insufficient evidence to tie the specific contact on the evening of the murder with the prior threats to the victim. I mean, he didn't kill her, he killed somebody else, and he never previously threatened the victim. All these previous threats were towards Nicole, and they happened quite a bit earlier, in some cases years earlier, before the night of the homicide. I would also like to reemphasize something I said in the reply brief, that the people's argument that it can be sufficient under, you could ignore the actual language of the communications because it's sufficient to just follow somebody around without saying a word, and you can still be convicted of stalking. And I believe the case they cited for that proposition is distinguishable from this case. Clearly, if a stranger gets fixated on somebody and starts following her around, and she becomes terrorized by the fact that this guy is obsessed with her and is following her around, that can be stalking. But that's not the case here. Nicole knew why he was following her around, and she was not afraid. If you read the entire stalking statute as a whole, to include section 4A as well as 4B, 4A is a legislative intent for stalking, and it is clear from the legislative intent that this isn't purely an objective. You can't just discount the subjective feelings of the victim. The subjective feelings of the victim have to be taken into account. The legislature, in their declaration, said stalking involves highly inappropriate intensity, persistence, and possessiveness, entailing great unpredictability and creates great stress and fear for the victim. Stalking involves severe intrusions on the victim's personal privacy and autonomy with an immediate and long-lasting impact on the quality of life, as well as risk to security and safety of the victim and persons close to the victim. Now, that indicates that you can't do what the people want to do and have to look at the conduct that's in connection with as promoting objectively a threat. You have to take the subjective fear and feelings of the victim into account. Otherwise, you are ignoring the legislative intent of the statute. Now, very quickly, I would like to move to the 404B evidence issue. In order to admit 404B evidence, in this case, in a homicide case, there's a two-step analysis you have to go through. You first, the people must establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the act occurred and was committed by the defendant. And then you move to the four-part SPOTO analysis. Here, the district court completely skipped over that first step. He did not have the people establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the act occurred and that the people committed it. And when the defense counsel tried to object to that, the defense counsel didn't. It was a little confusing in the objection because the defense counsel was calling that requirement establishing the prima facie case.
And Ms. Ruttenberg, isn't there a rejected notion associated with 404B that the phrase prima facie case refers to the existence of the crime before the jury? In other words, you have to establish a prima facie case that the defendant did the acts that he or she's being tried for today. So I guess the question is, isn't the use of that prima facie very confusing?
Well, and I think, yes, and I think the defense counsel's objection was very confusing, too. I think he was trying to get at the fact that the district court did not make that determination. Clearly, it did not have to be made before the jury, but it had to be made before the evidence could be admitted, and it was never made. And I have only a couple of seconds, which I'd like to reserve.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people. I just want to quickly address the 404B issue. I'd point out that the defense request about the prima facie case came, I think, 19 pages long after the trial court had made its ruling admitting the 404B evidence. And given the exchange between the trial court and defense counsel, it wasn't clear to me that that's what defense counsel was asking for, and I don't think it was clear to Judge Enzor either if that's what he was asking for. In any event, as I pointed out in the brief, the fact that the trial court admitted this evidence, it implicitly determined that that the prosecution had met its burden of proof.
Ms. Van Horn, is this even 404B evidence? I mean,
I think it's res geste, most of it.
Well, isn't it direct evidence of the stalking threats?
Some of it, and as I recall, it was kind of confusing because some of it they were admitting as direct evidence of the stalking threats, and then they were going to limit it as it related to the murder. And initially the court ruled that it was res geste, and then later when it found out that some of these incidents occurred not on the day of the murder or that evening, but the day before, changed its ruling to say it was 404B. And most of it is direct evidence of the stalking, of the credible threat. So I didn't really understand what was going on in that part of the record because I was looking at much of this and saying this is just res geste in my mind. But I think part of the reason maybe was it was trying to do something with it as it related to the murder charge as opposed to the stalking charge, trying to limit it. Harassment by stalking credible threat uses an objective standard to determine whether the actions are in connection with a credible threat, and that's in Bayer. This statute, unlike harassment by stalking serious emotional distress, doesn't require the victim to have any particular reaction to the threat. The victim doesn't even have to view it as a threat. And here we had harassment by stalking offense in this case was alleged to have occurred between January 5th and September 14th, 2005. And there were evidence of five credible threats in that time period alone, in addition to the events of the evening of the murder when the defendant was obviously watching the victim at some point, followed the victim, made numerous phone calls and sent her text messages. And that evidence presented in this context was sufficient for the jury to determine that these actions were in connection with a credible threat.
Counsel, were several of the credible threats were evidence that from things that she told her friend, is that correct?
Correct.
So they did come from her lips originally, although she denied them at trial, is that
correct? Right, and those included, and I'm just looking at the ones that happened after the date charged. In July or June of 2005, the defendant choked her. In July 2005, he threatened to kill her if he caught her with another man. On September 6th, he pushed her out of a car. On September 10th, he threatened to kill her and everyone she was with if he saw her at a nightclub. And those are the events occurring, of course, before the night of the murder, when the jury could infer he was watching her because he knew she was at the nightclub and then continued to call her and text her, and then showed up and stabbed the person she was with. So I do think there's sufficient evidence to show that his actions were in connection with a credible threat. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask that the judgment of conviction be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Rutenberg, you have about 5 seconds, so you might be able to clear your throat. We'll give you about 30 seconds here.
In my remaining seconds, I would just like to point out that Ms. Van Horn did misrepresent the record. The threat about the nightclub was, nobody said that the defendant said that he was going to kill Nicole and everybody she was with if he caught her at the nightclub. The verb used was to flash on, and nobody could give a good definition of what to flash on meant. Yell at, create a scene, but certainly the word kill or murder was never used. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can be set up and prepared on Hudgens versus Financial Indemnity, we'll hear that.